You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Under the Vienna Convention, the United Kingdom will now expel 23 Russian diplomats who have been identified as undeclared intelligence officers. They have just 1 week to leave.
The British Prime Minister Theresa May announces immediate retaliation against Russia in the latest diplomatic spat between the two countries. My guests today, Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including what the appointments of Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State and Gina Haspel as the CIA means to the US government. All that plus the new German cabinet takes shape and why coins are out of fashion. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Mary Dejewski, columnist for The Independent and Guardian, and Robert Fox, defence editor at the London Evening Standard. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you both here with us. Let's start the programme today looking at this diplomatic spat between the UK and Russia after the attempted murder, of course, of former spy Sergei Skripal, any involvement in which Russia continues to deny. Prime Minister Theresa May, as we heard at the top, announced that the UK would expel 23 Russian diplomats. The Russian embassy said this is unacceptable. Mary, let me come to you first of all. We're used to a certain frostiness, I think it's fair to say, of late between the two. What do the developments today, in particular May's announcement about these expulsions, what do they mean in terms of, you know, immediate impact in terms of diplomatic relations?
I think that's a very good question because, 23 sounds like an awful lot. And it's considerably more than were expelled after the Litvinenko poisoning. And it's considerably quicker than after the Litvinenko poisoning. And I think both those facts are designed to send a hardline message, but not just to Putin and Russia. It's designed to send a message to the British MPs and the members of her own party and government ministers to say, look, you may have misgivings about how the Litvinenko case was handled, but I am showing you as Prime Minister and former Home Secretary that I can be tough. Now, when you look at the other measures that were taken, you know, this is the one that will get the headlines. And the response from the Russians was entirely predictable. This is unacceptable. We can expect, you know, in the next few hours, we'll have one-for-one complete reciprocity from Moscow. I don't think we can expect anything less than that. But when you go down the list of what other measures that Theresa May is taking, you actually think, well, why aren't some of them being done already? I mean, you know, more stricter security for incoming private planes, measure against oligarchs. Well, are they not checked at the moment? Does nothing happen with that at the moment? Are our borders as porous as the sort of doom mongers say? We've got essentially what is the kernel of the American Magnitsky Act being put as a clause into English law that's going through the Commons at the moment. Now, that's all fine and good. It looks wonderful. People have been lobbying for it. But the fact is, we have loads of stuff on our statute book about money laundering and stuff that we can't enforce. And the Magnitsky Clause is a very limited entity which applies to people accused of violating human rights in Russia. And we're supposed to clamp down on their, refuse them visas, and we're supposed to confiscate their assets. But the fact is that most of the people who are involved in anything like that, even given the most sort of elastic definition, they're not going to be leaving the country or even thinking about leaving the country. And as far as assets, either they won't have many, they certainly won't have them in this country or anywhere where anybody can snatch them. So, you know, I think that the headline is designed for toughness. When you look at the smaller print, actually, it's not nearly as tough as it sort of cooked up to be.
Well, quite the reality check for Theresa May there, Robert. And what about that idea that, in a sense, May has come out with a rather predictable playbook? I mean, I imagine you were talking to various people today. What have they been saying? Is this sort of par for the course, or was that slight kind of, not cynicism, but almost scepticism that Mary alludes to there, was that something that you've come across as well?
Yeah, she's playing within herself, Mrs. May. She's not provoking the tiger too much because they're uncertain, I think, really what it's about. And to do the Sherlock Holmes on the news story of it, if that isn't a mixed metaphor, what's missing? They're not talking about the perps. They absolutely do not want to talk about who did it. Possibly they may not even really know. But this is going to be very important. Mm-hmm. And it's very important as to whether it was state-sponsored or it was some sort of spooks old boy club who then often go over to the dark side because there's a hell of a lot of ex-spooks and just involved in crime of all kinds, doing a freelance thing. Why did they choose this particular substance, which is very, very noxious and dangerous and certainly did catch? I'm not finger-jabbing like much of the tabloid press has been in the UK. The Portendown obviously did have quite a challenge to identify this thing because it was... If I can put it like this, it was in a catalogue. This is at the chemical warfare establishment at Portendown, just up the road from...
Ironically enough, not too far away.
Where, yeah, and I think that may have been part of the story. And the fact is that, you know, they didn't have it mixed up there. And one of the illusions, and this is the fascination of the story, if we can just talk about the dynamics, that I've heard two respectable BBC interviewers saying, oh, but this is a Cold War thing, as if it's a pharmacy. And that somebody went into one of the central chemical labs in Moscow and said, ah, well, we haven't tried that one. You know, it's next to aspirin. Aspirin. You have Novichok. It doesn't work like that. The most, if I can just say, the most interesting antecedent that they've been looking at, because one thing about this thing is it's binary. You have to put two together. And the most spectacular use of a binary agent in an assassination was the successful attempt on the life of Kim Jong-un's half-brother. Because briefly, what happened, it was two ladies separately, but working together, wiping a cloth on his face, a cloth each. One had one agent, it's now believed, the other had the other. So this is how it worked. And so putting this agent together, unless you're absolutely expert, and there obviously are one or two experts, this was high risk. Mm. But Mary and I were just discussing it before coming in. This really seems to have been quite a cack-handed operation, as was the Litvinenko murder operation.
Well, let's talk a bit about the mechanics, Mary. I don't want to sort of retread ground that's been trod this week, but the points Robert makes there are interesting. And just to obviously, I mean, okay, we're still in the realms of speculation. Is it some spooks old boy network? I wonder what the tie looks like, etc. Is it state sanctioned? But, you know, almost whether it's one or one or t'other, the complexities of this, cack-handed or other, is it part of the theatre? I mean, I know we're sort of second-guessing people's motivations, but the fact that it's public, as with the Litvinenko example, the fact that it's presumably designed to draw, it must be designed to draw in members of the public and other potential innocent bystanders, that must be part of the gesturing? Or is it wrong to jump to that conclusion?
Well, you see, I'm not sure that that's the right conclusion, because it seems to me that I actually agree with Robert that what we've got here is quite a cack-handed operation. And the fact that the two people who were attacked are still alive, albeit in critical condition, you know, that's the first thing that went wrong. And were they intended to be in a public place when the ambulance was called and they were incapable and all the rest of it? You know, we don't know. Mm. We don't know whether the contamination that there appears to have been in the restaurant and the pub, and though this seems to have been shrouded in a degree of deliberate mystery in the house, we simply don't know how those things come together. And it, I mean, I am also struck, as Robert has been, by the enormous gap that it seemed to me that from over the first week we heard has to be the Russians, has to be most likely state-sponsored operation from Russia. What we didn't have was any sense that British police were treating this as a crime, that they were going after people who had actually attacked somebody with potentially lethal poison, and that they'd done this in British Cathedral City, and there was none of that absolutely sort of basic police work. Mm. We were given none of the information about that. It was straight off to blame Russia. And then you ask, well, you know, one of the basic questions is, how did the poison get here? And, you know, Robert says it's a binary thing that they had to put it together. But was it something that his daughter brought from Russia? Is that something that the authorities know, which is why they're not actually looking for culprits? Or do they actually not know that? Mm. But there's these gigantic gaps, actual sort of practical, specific gaps, which I actually find quite worrying.
Well, no, and to that point, Robert, and you wanted to jump in there, but there does seem to be, a lack of urgency or practical immediacy in terms of the police or the response from the authorities. That looks from without. Again, is that because maybe things are being kept from us?
I think Mary's diagnosis, as ever, is absolutely brilliant and spot on. We're not looking at the gaps here. And it's a thing that I've suddenly started having to talk about publicly. What we're looking at is an era of weaponized news, which is highly emotional, highly commentator-led, and I was just recalling, and I only came across it 10 days ago, a remark by the great Ed Murrow, you know, of NBC, broadcasting from the roof of Broadcasting House as the Blitz goes down, giving you the actual thing. He said, about real reporter journalism, he said, the thing that counts is the last 3 feet. It's the person-to-person contact. And I think that we're so much in this bubble world. And I was, again, sorry, I sound like the Reverend Dr. Paisley used to say, going on about the BBC. But the BBC's account of this thing is so highly emotional and comment-driven. Why weren't we told? Why are the people in Salisbury so vulnerable? Whereas an old-fashioned crime reporter would do exactly what Mary has just described. And I think that there is a bit of Maskarovka going on there, deliberate confusion. I think the police are very happy that the media is not on the case. Who are the perps? Who really did this? It may not have been here, may have been in Moscow that they slipped something into the goodies that the Yulia was bringing over to her father. But what is so interesting, how little discussion there has been of this. And I think Scotland Yard and the others, because I'm sure actually this is going on at one level, and they were dead keen to get things, this is a wonderful thing. And they put every soldier, as far as I can make out, and so I'm informed, who had the remotest nuclear, biological and chemical warfare training, and they're not all that many, through, and they put them in the suits because it was, in the very best sense, a live training exercise, because we don't, the UK armed forces, we are told, don't have enough people trained in this. But it was a deflection from this real, real core of the story. Mm. And when that comes forward, as it did with Litvinenko, that takes the story into another place. I think that we're only in the first act of this. Diplomatically, I think it's getting extremely interesting, because once he gets re-elected, it's going to be very interesting how President Putin begins to play his cards, because he's got big, big issues, big things to deal with the West, which we're not even discussing yet.
I think there's one other slight potentially miscalculation on the British side, which is that while the Russians were given 36 hours to come up with an explanation or else, the Russians actually did respond to that. It's not true to say that Absolutely. They ignored that. What they came up with was a request to the British, given that we are both signatories to the International Convention on Chemical Weapons, this should apply. And under that convention, if you accuse us of doing this, then you have a responsibility to provide us with the evidence
within 10 days,
and you have to give us 10 days to consider it. And in a way, it seems to me that has presented the government maybe with a slight problem that they didn't anticipate, because now that goes to an international forum, and it seemed to me today that the British were sort of putting a bit of a brave face on this. But of course, if the British either don't have the evidence or they're not prepared to produce it, and they treat it as, you know, a top secret, then the Russians are going to come back at us and accuse us of flouting international law. And so I'm not sure that, you know, as Robert says, it's by no means over yet. Mm. But I'm not sure either that we hold all the cards now.
Just briefly before we move on, there were some threats to remove Russia Today potentially from the airwaves, looking to the yeah. media angle, which Robert alluded to before. And Russia has again suggested that if that happens, there could be again a tit for tat expulsion of British journalists. Just really quickly, Mary, mm-hmm. do you think that would happen? And how much, you know, does that add another layer of potential damage, another layer of people who potentially could be clarifying matters who are then absent?
Yes, I mean, you can, well, first of all, you can say that maybe there is another layer that the British are holding in reserve in case sort of other things happen. But I also think that throwing out or removing the licence from Russia Today is an invitation for Russia to expel whole operations, including the BBC, and I rather suspect they would have no qualms about doing that, and it would put Britain out. One of the reasons I think it's not been done is because, you know, the British upholders of freedom of speech and freedom of expression expel Russia Today. That is a very, very difficult thing, I think, to sell to the British public, quite apart from, you know, even though nobody particularly watches it. Yeah. I think the principle would be quite difficult to get across.
I think practically, Tom, very quickly, it would be utterly self-defeating. Mm. By the way, it is going to the UN Security Council, and I'm sure Mary is right. I think Britain will be told to comply with the Convention on Chemical Weapons and do this stuff. So watch this space.
Let's cross to the White House. Now, yesterday, CIA Director... That is the sort of inevitable reaction to that news, isn't it? Mike Pompeo was announced as new Secretary of State, replacing, of course, the rather sort of hapless and sad Rex Tillerson at the end, to take charge of the CIA. The choice was Pompeo's erstwhile deputy, Gina Haspel, making her the first woman to run the agency. I wonder what these appointments tell us about, well, if they tell us anything about where the US government is heading. Robert, in some ways, I guess it's, and this is a tricky one, a jump to make, but it almost seems a logical decision for Trump to have Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State. Is there even a Trumpian logic to the appointment?
Kindred spirit. But I think there's been a lot going on in the Tillerson story of late. Yes, it's ironic. When Trump was holding back in condemning Russia over Salisbury for whatever reasons, but other people like Macron were mentioning it, and Tillerson came out, you know, was forthright about it. But I don't think that's the bone of contention. I think the real problem with Tillerson was twofold, because Trump couldn't take to the style, because in a way, for all his haplessness, he's a grown-up, Tillerson, very, very experienced. And I think he was saying, whoa, about North Korea. You can't just suddenly decide, I'm going to talk to the young leader after all. I've called him all these things. Because the State Department were absolutely floored by that. They, you know, how are we going to do the preparation in time? And tried to bring a bit of professionalism into the whole thing. And the other problem that Tillerson has is the whole posture with Russia. No, I'm not going on about that. But Syria, with Turkey, Russia, Iran, Israel saying one thing and then doing another and then turning it all around in Egypt, it really needs an address. And he quite clearly was not on the same page as Jared Kushner on that. So there is a lot of smoke. But, you know, that Trump himself, and it's out of his mouth that he says he finds Pompeo more congenial to his way of thinking, to working with him. The question for Pompeo now is, how is he going to work with the generals? How is he going to work with Mattis, with McMaster, and above all with Kelly? And that's the one to spot, because allegedly, though, if the rumour mill, which proved absolutely right about Tillerson, is right, the next one to go is Mattis, I'm afraid.
Well, I heard McMaster first, but who knows? They seem to be in the firing line. Yeah. Mary, to that point, though, about Pompeo, maybe, you know, how does US foreign policy change under Pompeo? I mean, is that a legitimate question, or is the question still, is there a US foreign policy?
Well, I think probably the second is at least as valid a question. I think it possibly reorientates policy maybe back to the more traditional sphere of the Middle East or the greater Middle East and towards the Far East, as opposed to Europe and Russia. And if I were being a pessimist, which I'm not usually a pessimist, I would say that the removal of Tillerson is really the final chapter, at least for Trump's first term, if he gets another, of trying to improve relations with Russia. Because that's one of the reasons Tillerson was there. That was where his experience and expertise was seen as the most benefit, and where it seemed Trump and Tillerson saw most eye to eye. Now, once you remove that, as Congress has successfully done, really, from the Trump presidency, at least to date, then, you know, you really are looking probably for somebody else with different sorts of expertise and somebody who Trump gets on better with.
Mm. Robert, can I ask you about Gina Haspel? Because that's a controversial appointment. I know she was the deputy, I think, working under Mike Pompeo at the agency before. But obviously, you know, we shouldn't forget there were a number of quite detailed allegations or suggestions about the way she had run various sort of interrogation facilities in Southeast Asia and all the rest. Do you have concerns about the function of CIA under her ambit?
Yeah, Zero Dark 30 and that kind of craziness that went on with the agency. And I must say, there are several strands in this conversation, in this particular part of the conversation that leads to what we started with, mm. with Russia, and Mary is absolutely right. And I must say that the kind of things that she was associated with, but not necessarily responsible for, actually do make agencies like the French External Intelligence Agency, MI6, look like real grown-ups by comparison. And that does worry me, because I think there are some very grown-up issues that have to be addressed. Obviously, it seems to be the word of a conversation grown up. But Russia, it is so complex now. One of the things that I wanted to get out before, but certainly Pompeo is going to have to address with Mattis, if he's still there, is the upcoming NATO summit, which is a big one, due in Brussels in June. Because lo and behold, and this is why, with some reason, the Russians are so worried, Ukraine's membership of the alliance is on the agenda again, which I find absolutely baffling. And you feel like saying, no, they've overpromised that alliance. I'm talking about NATO, on bringing the Baltics in far too soon and that whole thing. And it's a big, big mess. But the other thing where I think you can possibly expect something quite difficult with Pompeo is that he sees eye to eye, more eye to eye than Tillerson did with the president on the Iran nuclear deal. And I don't know whether they're going to try to torpedo that. Tillerson has explained to Trump, it is not just US property, this. It is six, seven parties, if you take Iran itself, that are involved in this, which he seems to find it very, very difficult to get his head around. What I fear, though, with this kind of personality, there'd be a lot of gesture politics, like moving the embassy to Jerusalem.
I think I'd just like to put in a sort of a woman's word at this stage about Gina Haspel. She is going to become the first female head of the CIA. And I think it's quite interesting. You know, Robert was talking about, as it were, her track record and the sort of dubious aspects, as would be seen from Europe and from some sections of American opinion, in her past. But I think in some ways, from inside the agency, that could very well be seen as a saving grace. You know, this is one tough woman who's been involved in the sort of the front edge of what American intelligence is all about. And so maybe that means she is inoculated to an extent against the criticism that there would obviously be about having a woman as head of the CIA.
Indeed, it's funny, we could be talking about in some respects, a progressive appointment from Trump, which I guess is something to welcome, a potential silver.
Very useful when it comes to China too, which is really a big one, and they've been very unintelligent about so far. Mm.
Well, let's move on and just talk briefly about what's been happening in Germany. After a number of months of negotiations, a new German cabinet was sworn in, a much weakened Angela Merkel in her fourth term as leader since 2005. We'll continue in grand coalition with the Social Democrats. The cabinet's more youthful in appearance, much changed. I think only one minister is in the same job, Ursula von der Leyen at Defence. Robert, in relatively briefly, is there much to read into Merkel's choices? Because one rather seems that in terms of this cabinet and the cabinet building process, she's very much had sort of one hand tied behind her back.
She moves into a new phase very quickly. How much she can live down the criticism which has been hurled at her during the election campaign, principally that it's threefold, actually, from her immediate international entourage as well. It's not only the refugees and letting in so many Syrian refugees, as it was seen at the time, which has been a tremendous stick for the outright and so on. There's also the question of austerity and the German vision, epitomised by Schäuble, the old finance minister, of very, very tight, disciplined policies towards the euro and the European monetary system. But the other thing, curiously, is that there is a great deal of reproach, I don't know whether Mary picks this up, for Merkel for bungling Brexit, which is not as mad as it sounds, because the feeling is that she could have really gripped Cameron and stopped him going into this crazy way, which is actually causing Europe a lot of grief. The chauvinist press in the UK, you wouldn't read it from that, but they are finding it very, very difficult indeed, because they've got a whole host of negotiations and so on, and actually both of them don't want to annoy and don't want to have an upset Britain on their borders.
That's an interesting point, isn't it, Mary? I mean, should Mutti have been the saviour for the Remainers? The unlikely choice.
Well, I think that in some ways Cameron had rather hoped that she would be, but it didn't happen. And I tend to think that at least some of the criticism about that she could actually have saved Brexit from happening is probably a bit unfair. But I do think that Merkel goes into this coalition, which is probably her last government, considerably weaker, not just than last time, but than she'd hoped. Mm. I mean, this is her third choice of coalition. She wanted a free market centre-right coalition. That was her first choice. It was ruled out by the election. Her second choice was what was called the Jamaica coalition. Talks collapsed. And what she's left with is a replica of her previous grand coalition, but having had to give away some of the key positions.
Well, and to that point, just to jump in, particularly Horst Seehofer's interior ministry, obviously that was kind of, you know, she was damned if she didn't, damned if she didn't. That had to happen. What do you make of those dynamics? I mean, are they going to be jockeying for position? And I guess as one very brief aside, the fact that it's the interior construction and homeland Heimat ministry. Yeah. Some people have jumped on that as very significant. I wonder, does Mary Dzhevsky think it is or it isn't?
I mean, what I think is significant is the completely changed dynamic, given that the centre-left now has charge of the finance ministry and the foreign ministry. Foreign ministry's traditional finance ministry certainly isn't. But also, I think I've never really had much trepidation about whether Merkel's coalitions in the past would actually fail. I've generally been more confident than a lot of people that they would survive. And she is a very experienced and intelligent operator in making the concessions that need to be made and navigating what happens then. But in this case, I mean, as Robert said, she is under all sorts of pressure from all sides. Yeah. And she's now sharing power with a centre-left party, which is itself not completely united. Her own alliance with the CSU is very much under strain because of the criticism from the right about migration and everything to do with that. So while her track record would suggest that she can actually go to the full term with the current coalition, I think this one is the most fragile that she's been in.
I just want to jump in there because we're nearly out of time, and I wanted to ask about a potentially sad news story that perhaps has another silver lining, and that was for lovers of coins in this country. The 1p and 2p pieces, they were staring down the barrel, but lo, their future has been saved. Theresa May, one would have thought she'd be busy with other things, but she's pronounced on this and they will be sticking around. Robert Fox, do you welcome this news? Should we even care?
I like coins. I do not care a fig about the 1p and the 2p piece because they are a jolly nuisance and I rarely, if ever, use them.
Mary Dzhevsky? No. There's something charming about the old coppers, isn't there?
Well, they're so heavy to carry around because now
they get
you,
grungy. So
now you hardly use them. The point is you hardly use them now. Yeah. So they all congregate at the bottom of your purse and they weigh a ton. So I would actually be quite happy to see them go. And you gather that actually shopkeepers are now, everything is being priced so that it's easier on the on the touch card arrangement. And so maybe they've already gone, except we've hardly noticed.
The irresistible flight of technology. A final note to you, Robert, on this. There's a football team in North London building what will be this country's first cashless stadium. It's Tottenham Hotspur. Would that technological advance be enough for you to switch your loyalties?
I have down tools supporting the Arsenal Football Club because of the thoroughly spoilt brat behaviour of one Alexis Sanchez. I'm about to renew my enthusiasm. Poor old Tottenham. I think they've got a bit of problem still with their various stadia that they've been juggling.
We'll leave that there. International listeners, you may have to get on the Google machine to find out what that's all about. Robert Fox and Mary Dzhevsky, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. The programme was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, research by Pierre-Antoine Denis, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to them all. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. Do be sure to tune in. But from me, Tom Edwards, and from all the Wednesday team, thank you very much for listening.